The History Today cover story for July is by Charles Luddington. It's called Walpole, Whigs and Wine, and concerns the way in which England's shifting social order, following what is now called, or was called, the Glorious Revolution, defined itself. In this case, through the consumption of fine claret. We have Charles with us today. And may I ask you, Charles, there is a difference between the fine luxury claret that we're talking about towards the end of the 17th century and the kind of claret that had been consumed in England for many centuries. Can you tell us the difference between them?
Absolutely. First of all, it's wonderful to be on, and delighted to talk to everyone today. And the distinction that is important to understand is between a traditional type of claret. In fact, the word claret itself gives away its origins as a sort of a small, relatively clear, probably rosé wine that had been made in the Bordeaux region, largely for the English market, of course, going back to the time when Bordeaux was, in many ways, the vineyard or the vineyard, as you say, of England because of Eleanor of Aquitaine's marriage to Henry II. In any event, all that was lost in 1453 at the end of the Hundred Years' War, but the type of wine that emerged from there was still what we might call a simple vin de pays, peasant wine, again, probably rosé in color, very light in body, and meant to be consumed within the year. But then in the mid-17th century, what happened was a man named Arnaud de Pontac, who was the premier président, the first president of the Parliament of Bordeaux, who had some very prime property, notably an estate that he called Aubryon, created a wine. He seems to be the first to have done it. Created a wine in which he selected the grapes more carefully, probably used only red grapes, let the wine actually ferment for longer, make a more concentrated wine. And in any event, he was trying to create a luxury product for the English market. Specifically, he was sending that wine, or he sent that wine in 1660 to the court of Charles II. Literally within a month of Charles's return to the throne, we have evidence of his wine buyer, his butler, buying some wine called, in Latin in this case, Aubryono, but of course it was Aubryon. And this wine was distinctly different in terms of its quality, in terms of its color, and we know that because of the evidence of Samuel Pepys, who wrote in 1663 in his diary, the remarkable, an extraordinary wine, the taste was different, etc. I'm forgetting the exact quote, but in any event, he noted very clearly that it was a different type of wine than anything he'd ever had before called claret. And so that wine was the type of wine, again, that was produced for the English market, and that helped to, in the end, allow claret to succeed on the English market despite the embargoes and the high taxes that were imposed upon it during the late 17th century.
And this wine, this claret, is more like, in fact, it is the ancestor of the claret we know today, with the great names not just of Aubryon, but of Margaux, Lafite, Latour. This is where it comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. This is that very period. In fact, as I try to explain in the article, one of the things that one begins to see, Aubryon, the name, as I said, is first seen in 1660, but in the first 5 years of the 18th century, that is during the very period, during the War of the Spanish Succession, when you'd think, in fact, that high-quality Bordeaux or, in fact, French wine of any sort would not be arriving in England because there was an embargo on French goods. But it's during this very period that one begins to see the names, specifically in auction records from London, the names Lafitte, Latour, Margaux, arriving in England. One also sees the same names in some of the cellar records of people like Baron Harvey, the Earl of Sunderland, a variety of, again, high-ranking Whigs in particular, who seem to be very fond of them. But absolutely, in that period, during Queen Anne's reign, and during a war, no less, in which there's officially an embargo on French goods, the other three first-growth clarets There were four initially up until the 1970s when Mouton joined. But all those wines are known by name by elite English consumers by around 1705.
And what we have at the time of Queen Anne's reign, in the wake of what used to at least be known as the Glorious Revolution, is the great division in English politics between the Tory party and the Whig party. And it's the Whigs that become associated with the consumption of fine claret. Can you explain that, please?
Well, that's actually the that conundrum was what first got me excited about this topic, which I had heard and read in various books that claret was supposed to be the Tory wine and port was supposed to be the Whig wine. And what I then discovered when looking at the cellar records was, in fact, in many ways, it was just the opposite. Well, not exactly the opposite, but certainly many, many leading Whigs were drinking claret, so it was hardly a Tory wine. For the Whigs, claret was ended up, on a popular level, Whig politicians were trying to discourage the importation of French wines, because, of course, the French were the real enemies in their mind, where for the Tories, the French might not have been wonderful, but the Dutch were the real concern. But so on a popular level, the Whigs were trying to discourage the importation of French wines. But for their own consumption, French wines were very important for establishing their credentials as worthy of authority and establishing their rule as legitimate, especially because many of them came from commercial backgrounds. They couldn't assert their own aristocratic identities. And therefore, we have the right to rule over you simply because we're aristocrats. Instead, they had to ground their authority in their moral and aesthetic credentials, and that came from, as I argue, politeness in general. That is, they had to show through their behavior and through their aesthetic choices that they were morally worthy and therefore politically legitimate. And one of the things that Whigs in particular used as a way to assert that authority was wine. Now, some might say, why wine? Well, the issue there was that wine still had, because of its historic connections to both the court and to the church through the Eucharist, it still had this residual implications of authority. And so wine, sort of like a gentleman, a politician wearing a tie today, a male politician, you have to wear a suit and tie to be taken seriously. You have to drink wine on various public and indeed private occasions to show that you are you have political authority, but then it's what you do with that wine. Can you discuss that wine?
So how, when you talk about this establishing their connoisseurship, their aesthetic credentials, where did they do this to make people realize that they were worthy of this authority?
That's a very good question, the one that often comes up. How is this something that people knew about? Well, take someone like Walpole, for example. When he held his Norfolk Congresses, what were called his Norfolk Congresses up at Haughton in Norfolk, up near King's Lynn, he would invite upwards to 50 gentlemen to come up with him, and they ranged from quite wealthy squires to aristocrats to prominent clergymen. And so the performance there, again, was not on a massive scale of thousands of people, but certainly he would both, by serving it, by talking about it in front of 50 societal leaders every year, twice a year sometimes, that was part of the performance. Another part of the performance would come through the display in conversation pieces. That is, the performance of drinking and tasting claret was then represented in paintings, oil paintings referred to as conversation pieces, which of course are group portraits, showing generally men, but men and women sometimes, but when drinking wine, almost always simply men, performing the act of aesthetic appreciation.
And Walpole's very much the person who first understands, I suppose, that wealth, although he was an immensely wealthy man, was not enough in politics anymore, in a post-aristocratic world, or at least one where the aristocracy is challenged. There are issues of taste, and power is no longer that of breeding or blood. It's about taste.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, for Walpole, I argue that it was sort of integral to his own transformation from someone who genuinely was a came from the squirearchy, whose father was a sort of an East Anglian rustic. And for Walpole, who obviously very much, you know, who made it in that political world in a dramatic fashion, that claret was very much part, both a reflection of his rise to power, as well as something that helped him rise up. That is, if he could show, among other polite gentlemen at an early age, that he was one of them through his consumption, it wasn't simply a reflection of his power, it was something that helped to get him there and keep him there in the first instance. And yes, you know, he had an incredible penchant for fine wines, Aubryon, Lafitte, Margaux, Latour. We find all of them in his cellar records. So he was quite aware of the political implications and the social implications of wine, because as I just mentioned, he also, while luxury claret was very much his favorite wine, one of the things that's also interesting is how much Portuguese wine he did have, again, but for a very different audience. So in that sense, while my article is about claret and the way that it helped to establish the legitimacy of the elite and the credentials of the elite, there was wine, a variety of wines were used as a way to establish credentials within different social groups.
Well, thank you, Charles. Walpole, Wigs and Wine, Charles's article, is the cover story for the July edition of History Today. And thank you very much. It's fascinating stuff, Charles. Thank you.
Well,